Hey, Andrew here. Before we start today's episode, I wanted to let you know that our next Global Sport Matters digital issue will be dropping on Friday, September 25th. In that issue, we're going to be focusing on the reset of college sport, and we will have reporting looking at a 10-year snapshot of the NCAA and Power 5 head coaching hires, as well as how COVID-19 and the reawakening on race is impacting the world of college sport. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter at globalsportmatters.com and click on the envelope icon to sign up. Once again, that issue drops on Friday, September 25th, looking at the reset of college sport. And now, the show. Before the Varsity Blues scandal dominated the headlines, there was Jerome Allen, a beloved ex-pro basketball player turned head coach at Penn's Wharton School, who in 2018 pleaded guilty to accepting bribes in exchange for Morris Esformus' admission into the Ivy League. Jerome first met Morris's father, Philip Esformus, in 2013. Philip was a healthcare executive and a desperate parent with a bag full of cash looking to get his son on the team. Quote, "If the coach could make that happen," he said, "they would be family for life," end quote. But Morris would never wear the Quakers jersey. And soon enough, Jerome Allen would find himself swept in the center of one of the largest healthcare fraud cases brought down by the federal government and sentenced with a 15-year show cause penalty from the NCAA. On this episode of the Global Sport Matters podcast, part one of the Jerome Allen interview with Kenneth Shropshire of the Global Sport Institute and Bill Roden of ESPN's The Undefeated. And joining from the NBA bubble, Jerome Allen. This is the Global Sport Matters podcast.
How is life in the bubble, especially, you know, the day after the, well, I guess we're 2 days after now, Jacob Blake, and got to be just more intensity within the bubble with the day-to-day stuff going on. But how's life in there with that and everything else?
Well, I guess it's twofold. One is that, you know, I'll quickly say I think the NBA has done about as good as a job as they possibly could have in terms of setting up this environment and all the things that are in place to provide these young men with the opportunity to compete from the daily kind of regimen of, you know, all the testing and the meal preps and all, you know, a lot of people have had to have their hand in just kind of making this run as smoothly as possibly could have. But with that being said, I don't think that everybody here is insulated from, you know, all the other things that are going on in our country. I think there are a lot of people here that are informed. We've all, you know, been following just, you know, the media and their coverage of the events that continue to plague our nation. It's kind of from my perspective, you know, I kind of look at it like, you know, we were all in 1955 shocked by the open casket that Emmett Till's mother wanted to have, and how that shocked people into movement, and then obviously the march from Selma to Montgomery, and how that was handled by law enforcement in that area, and it was captured on television, and how that shocked people in the movement, and then some 60 plus years later, how the death of George Floyd in that 8 minutes and 46 seconds in particular, how it was captured and how that shocked people into movement again. And so, you know, it raises the question, you know, what really has changed, you know, and that 60 year gap. And so to kind of answer your question about, you know, how are things in the bubble, for at least from my perspective, and I'm not speaking for I'm not the representative of the bubble. But from our perspective, I'd like to argue what really has changed, and you know, it's fatiguing, and, you know, it's frustrating, And I think, you know, this generation of athletes have done a tremendous job and trying to clutch the things that they, you know, deem important in terms of fighting for change. You know, but, you know, I'm kind of not necessarily numb, but I'm past the symbolism and the hashtags and the rally cries, because I know that, you know, systems are still in place that still plague this country, and I won't be fooled by just the how others, you know, hold on to the symbolism and convince me to think that the needle has moved. And so that's kind of like, you know, how are things with me, you know, in the bubble. But I think I somewhat echo the sentiments of a number of people down here to say that it's frustrating and it's fatiguing, and we're not removed from the things that are going on in this nation just because we're down here.
You were saying, you know, you got a son who's 10 and you got a son who's 25, and your son who's 25 is basically the age of a lot of the guys that you deal with, you know, that same sort of age. Has this given you an opportunity to engage with a lot of guys? I know a lot of your guys, some of your guys are younger than your son. So to some extent, it almost breaks down the barrier between coach and player. Have you noticed, has there been a lot of conversation in the bubble? I saw George Hill saying, you know, right after the shooting in Milwaukee and Kenosha, he was saying, I'm sorry, I'm even here, you know, because remember, that was the thing going into the bubble. Some people were saying, man, why are we going into the bubble? But so what kind of conversations have you been having, or have you been having conversations?
As I'm standing on my own soapbox and say, you know, I have a 10-year-old son and a 25-year-old son, and then I'm 47, and just how we are viewing the same events really from three different perspectives. And it's not necessarily, you know, frustrating, but it is, it kind of gives you a glimpse as to where people are at, you know, as they kind of, you know, march through this thing, for lack of a better way of saying it. But, you know, Coach Stevens has done a tremendous job of just, you know, allowing our guys, and I hate to say allow, but just being supportive in terms of, you know, giving guys the opportunity to really vent their frustrations and talk about the things that they feel as though they need to express. And the one thing that, you know, I would say that's incumbent upon, you know, everyone who holds the position of coach, especially, you know, a coach of color, is that, we don't have the title just to coach basketball. It's not necessarily always about X's and O's. And I would like to think these things will kind of propel an athlete forward if you can service them the right way, further than teaching them how to, you know, execute or read the progressions of a pick and roll. And so I would be doing them a disservice if I just was in this space, whether we were in this current climate or not, and just talking about basketball. And it's about life, and it's about, you know, family, and about growing, and it's about failing, it's about succeeding, it's about just, you know, all the things that they will face in life that they aren't privy to studying beforehand. Because as events come upon us, you know, some of them may be unprecedented, you know, i.e., you know, with us dealing with the pandemic, but some may just be, you know, reoccurring events that we were we may have forgotten about, or that we just kind of just go through, whether it's relationships with family and, or, you know, dealing with money, or whether it's just, you know, how to manage fame, you know, how to manage, you know, depression, you know, how to manage anxiety, how to just deal with, you know, the mental part of the game, how to just, you know, deal with, you know, with life in itself. And so, you know, Brad has kind of been at the forefront of trying to charge us as a staff to holistically develop our players. And I like to think this, you know, more so than any time ever, you know, that's important for a time like now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, Jerome, I'm wondering, you know, I had a chance to talk to a couple of teams, a couple of sports, and for one of the one of the times in my life, I feel like I'm the old guy trying to talk to these young players, and you know, and I've diverted more to the historian than trying to be the advisor. Guru, I just kind of, like you mentioned Emmett Till and kind of going through the history stuff. You weren't even living then, but you've got the, you know, got the history down. How have you, I know you connect, and I see you on the floor all the time connecting with guys one-on-one, kind of private conversations. Has this topic been any different or any more intense than others? Are they open to you to really get into this, or are you the 47-year-old guy that's a little bit out of touch?
Yeah, no, you know, I guess the beauty of it is that, you know, any conversation you have with anyone, like, it's an exchange, right? So, the back and forth, for the conversation to be productive has to be received regardless of, you know, what I'm saying. It's not received. It's just me just talking. And so I think I've worked hard enough to gain the respect and the trust of the players that, you know, we currently have, because I've made my entire disposition about them, right? And not to say that it's manipulative, because I try to tie everything back to their bottom line, but this experience really isn't about me, right? It's just like, you know, how can I help someone else, like, get whatever it is that God got for my, you know, out of life. And so with that being said, when I talk about, it's funny. It's like, you know, Jaylen Brown, for example, and Marcus Smart and Kanter and Jason Tatum and Daniel, we had a lot of guys out there marching, protesting, and they have horns and they're in the mix. Right. And I don't want to discredit their efforts. I think, you know, those things, you know, are needed, right? And so by me being proud of them in terms of taking a stance, right, for what they believe in, right, it's almost like they're tired, they're angry, they're upset, right? And it's like really not so much their first time in terms of dealing with the bigger issue, but like it's like, oh, this is really what we're talking about. It allows me to stand on my soapbox and say, well, really, you know, here were some other things that previously happened, right, that kind of goes, you know, runs parallel to these current events, right? And so it almost gives credibility to my argument when I say, well, I would like to argue what really has changed, right, in terms of what's really in the hearts of people that don't look like me, right? You know, laws can put certain things into play, right? But laws will not like penetrate someone's heart, right? It just will may possibly mandate that they do something that may change their makeup. And so it just gives me credibility when I steer the conversations with these guys, you know, in that direction. And they think I'm old and I'm a hater anyway about what I was doing, because I always talk about, like, you know, what I would have did to them in my prime.
Right. But, I'm really just trying to figure out when old starts. I'm trying to see if you're old yet. So, but no, that's so funny.
Hey, Drew, I was curious. I mean, I know I want to ask you about your book, and congratulations, by the way, about the book. But before we talk about that, I'm still fascinated by this whole bubble thing. And if we could get into a little ball, you've seen all these scoring records, you know, I mean, 100 last night, 145 points or something, you know. And I'm wondering, is there something about playing in the bubble with no home crowds? It's kind of a neutral crowd. People talk about the depth perception is better. As you, as a former player and scorer and all that kind of stuff, is the bubble conducive? I know a lot of guys are going stir crazy, but let's just talk about basketball. Is it conducive to more intense competition? Is it inducive with neutral arenas to better competition or higher scoring?
I think it's a great question. You know, we you know, we think about, you know, I think it goes twofold. So when, if there was a regular like home and away concept going on, right? And there's a travel component in it. And then you have kind of like the home court advantage and the fans, and the support is important and is real. And it will affect, you know, it will affect the game. But, you know, the flip side of being here is that there's less travel, you know, on the guys and the taxing of that, you know, in terms of their bodies. But it also, it could work against them in terms of when guys get to competing and them being able to find their place of rest inside their homes, right? And there's a certain element that's connected to that. And you're just in terms of finding their spot or their rhythm. And so as far as like the game in itself, the, you know, depth perceptions, I was never a shooter. So I would always blame every time I had a bad on the depth perception. But it's just, I found that the teams that are more connected in terms of spirit and chemistry have found their way or their groove, kind of like, you know, in this space. And I wouldn't say that it's the rims or the depth perception, but, you know, a lot of it has to do with obviously, you know, game planning, but, you know, spirit and chemistry in an environment such as this, you know, I think will go a long way, probably more so than any other time. But, you know, the reality of it is, you know, this could be more challenging because of the every other day and just the aesthetics of dealing with kind of going back to the same space every day and just that mental aspect of it. So it goes both ways. And I'm just hoping that no one puts 154 points, up on us. So.
Right. Yeah. Just one last question. Yeah, there's been a lot of talk about Luka, who's a great player. I mean, you know, but phenomenal young player. And I say phenomenal young player is in that, we could be very narrow-minded. We could live in the moment. One day you're great, then the next day you're not. And so I was wondering, and this could be a prejudice on my part. So when he hit the game, when he shot the other day, you know, I'm thinking, oh, God, here we go. We're going to have to hear about this for the next 3 days, how this guy is like the greatest of all time, and he surpassed Bill Russell, and I always feel there's a little great white hopeism, and I hate to like go there, you know, but I've always, for whatever reason, I'm always attuned to that, just because in the media, I see, you know, still an overly white sports media, and you always try to create these heroes, and I just wonder how you walk that line, because you've played against a lot of great white players, great players, all, you know, I'm just wondering how you walk that line between, you know, you sort of got to earn it. Sometimes if you're a white player, you may get a little more, you know, what do you think about that?
Now, before you answer, Jerome, you know, we're Philly and we know Joe Frazier is the greatest boxer of all time. And Bill's Woodard, he's a Rocky hater. He can't believe he's the greatest athlete ever out of Philadelphia.
Well, you don't believe it either.
That's all the time.
you don't believe that either. It's not just me.
Again. Man,
don't defend. Don't let Jerome answer the question.
Well, again, I'd be the first to tell you he's not the greatest athlete to ever come out of Philly because he's not from Philly. One, two, he's an
South
actor.
Carolina.
Yeah. He's an actor. Yeah.
Well, maybe see, Ken is from LA.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I go back to just like the narrative around storytelling, right? And so, Luka's been phenomenal, you know, for that franchise and his growth and what he's been able to accomplish, and he's exciting, and I think, you know, the coaching staff has given him a platform to really display his talents, and he's done a phenomenal job. But to kind of like, you know, answer your question, I try not to look at it from that perspective, although that perspective is real, you know, I think about when Johnny Bryant was just hired by the New York Knicks to be the associate head coach there. And I read an article, and someone wrote an article about the hire, and they just talked about it, player development. That's why he got this opportunity, right? And so I was just saying, regardless of why he got the opportunity, it's like, you know, when Black coaches, you know, get an opportunity, sometimes it's player development or his relationship with the players, right?
Right.
Why did they have to lead, you know, with that? Or they hire him because they're trying to get, someone else and free agency. It's like, you know, you're writing a story trying to cover the, the hire. You know, in the back of my mind, you know, I always kind of flinch a little bit when I've seen a number of people get hired before, and that wasn't the slant. And so to answer your question, right, you know, people, you know, have this, you know, ability to create stories, right, create narratives around whatever they choose to, right? And so I try not to. And although sometimes I get upset, right, but I try not to lead with it because it's just I just try to see it for what it is. And Luka has been phenomenal. And you know, like we're providing content for people to be, you know, entertained. This sports really is. And so, like the storylines around the gifts and the talents is really kind of what, you know, what captivates people. And so I wouldn't have been surprised if that would have been, you know, the narrative. So,
you know, Jerome, another little known story is that a young man named Bill Roden's one that asked Zeke a question about Larry Bird and got him in trouble so many years ago. So he's been on this kick for a while.
Well, you know, I don't know if I answered the question, but
I don't think it was you, Bill. I don't think it was you.
But I would have. But you know, the thing he said, and again, you know, you're in the NBA family, so we're not trying to, you know, interrupt that. But you know, I think one of the things that Zeke said, because you know, you're watching Donovan Mitchell, and Donovan Mitchell and was, you know, the brother from Denver, Jamal Murray, just having like phenomenal. I mean, like night after night after night, just putting up huge numbers. And it reminds me of something. I remember I was doing a story on Reggie Jackson a while back, and so I was at the All-Star game, and I asked Bill White, you know, we at the All-Star game, and I said, well, I didn't realize that Bill White hated Reggie, but I said, so Reggie, Bill, why is Reggie great? He said, great. I said, well, shit, if he's great, what is Willie Mays? If he's great, what is Hank Aaron? You know, we throw these words around. So I guess to kind of close out this part of the conversation, I'm really a test of time person. Like, you could have a nice game or a nice season, but are you going to have 5 great seasons? You know, like 10, you know, where Jim Brown averages, you know, 7 yards a carry for 9 years, when everybody, you know, Kobe Bryant, LeBron, where guys just do a game planning for you, you know, and you're still hitting like 30 points. To me, you know, whether it's Aretha Franklin or Patti LaBelle or whatever, it's like the test of time, you know. So that's.
He is a, you know, phenomenal player. I think the league in itself, whether it's Jamal Murray, Donovan Mitchell, Luka Doncic, you know, we have 2 young guys that are pretty special, and Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown, and so the storytelling, the marketing around convincing people to spend their, you know, their disposable income on entertainment, you know, there's a certain level of not necessarily mystique, but hope in terms of that, you know, that's needed. And and I think the league is in a great place right now in terms of the talent, and those guys have been phenomenal thus far. And I'm just hoping that we could we, as in the Boston Celtics, could be in this bubble for as long as we possibly can. Remember John Chaney always saying, and Fran Dunphy kind of held on to this. He'd say, guys, I'm not trying to win 14 league games. I'm trying to win one league game 14 times. And so, we're just trying to be here, for one game as many times as we can.
So Jerome, I mean, with all my heart, we're blessed to have known each other for now decades. I mean, I met you as a young teenager, kind of learned your way around the University of Pennsylvania. You grew up in Philadelphia and came to Penn, actually, and you could have gone a lot of different places. I mean, you were really the unique story in the moment of a kid who could have gone to any of the weren't been yet called Power Five schools and played, and chose to come to get the Ivy education, to get the advantages that existed at a place that I have come to understand that you didn't even know that much about for a good part of your life, even though it was a 15-minute bus ride from where you grew up most of your life. And we got to know each other a little bit then. I remember in your search for an agent, I was involved in that process and sitting up with you and the coach and a couple of different agent interviews. You made what I thought was the right decision there. You end up going in the draft, going overseas. And most impressive to me in terms of the academic piece was that how long were you overseas before you came back and said, I'm going to get this done?
Well, officially 14 years.
14 years.
Wow.
Unlike some of your, let's say specifically some of your teammates and others that came for the Ivy education, I mean, you came to complete it. You came back to get it done and get the degree some years later. And that's where we really reconnected. Although I'd see you occasionally when you'd come through. And that's where you ended up. I mean, and this might be a good place to start and then back up from, where you ended up becoming a coach and then becoming the head coach at Penn. And the events, from then on. But as you say in your book, When the Alphabet Comes, a lot of your life before then really prepared you for the life that's happened since the events that occurred at Penn. So why don't you tell us, why you wrote the book and why now, and especially for listeners who don't know the story, because it got shrouded in some other things that we'll talk about, some other bigger names than you were caught up in similar issues. So sometimes people were kind of confused and don't know how the two interact. But why don't you talk about why you wrote it, and then just generally what it's about, and then I know Bill's really got some stuff to drill into.
Yeah. So at first, when I first decided to write the book, and people would ask me why, I tried to give this wordy answer. Right. I tried to give them what I thought they wanted to hear, right? And this grand Ivy League kind of like depiction of just this philosophical kind of like outlook on. And then I just stopped and I just said, you know what? I just want to give my testimony. And I left it at that. And so many things that transpired around the case that forced me to kind of almost not so much the placebo effect, but forced me to kind of really go back and just really dissect certain parts of my life, right? To kind of make sense of it all, right? Not so much like it's one thing to address the problem. I mean, to be aware of the problem, but really trying to find a genesis of just anything in life, whether it's a like or whether it's an issue. Is really kind of like a trying experience. And so going through all of that, kind of allowed me to birth out this story that's kind of centered around the case, but it's not really, you know, it's not like someone was asking me, is it a book on spirituality? Is it a book on sports? Is it a book on leadership? Is it a biography? Is it a memoir? Is it, and I was like, you know what? It's not just one thing, you know, and I think it touches on, you know, so much, whether it's, you know, me talking about just how human beings carry just this over sense of judgment, right? And then building a story around how judgment played out in my life in terms of, you know, one day we played Harvard at the Palestra, and before the game, my father is outside asking people for change as they come into the gym, right? And he's so high that he doesn't even know where he's at, right? And so I'm on the court warming up for pregame, and someone informs me that he's outside begging, right? And so I'm talking, like, I break down. I got tears in my eyes, snot in my nose. It's all running down my face, meeting right at my upper lip. And I'm like, I hate him. I want him to stay away from me. Why would he embarrass me like that? The one thing that I didn't want the people at Penn to know is that he was a drug addict, right? And so fast forward, you know, me vowing to hate him for the rest of my life, 26 years later, you know, the Wharton School undergraduate graduation was held in the Palestra in the same building. And my son, him and I have the same name, he's class of 2018, he wins one of the Dean's Awards, right? It's one of the six students, right? And he stands up and people are cheering his name and clapping and the family is going off. And that same space where I was cheered for a completely different reason, right? For he was now being celebrated, and I was so in awe and paralyzed by it. Like, I got overwhelmed. I just sat there like couldn't believe it, right? Well, in that same space, 26 years later, I did the same thing to him, right? Mm. So my story was in was covered by the whole world, you know, while he's on campus, right? All of this stuff breaks, and we have the same name, we went to the same university, got the same degree, studied the same thing. And he carved out his own space and did it his way. And now I'm begging for that compassion and empathy and forgiveness, the same stuff I wasn't willing to afford my own father, you know, when he was out front of the Palestra, right? And so now when a judge gets judged and the shoes on the other foot is completely different. So going through like the stuff around the case, you know, allowed me to really address some of the hypocrisy I was carrying in my own life, you know, and just, you know, the access and privilege, my disdain for it. Anytime it was exercised in front of me, like I got upset, but wasn't I really trying to afford those same things to my own children? And, you know, having the chance to go work underneath Greg Popovich as an assistant with the Spurs while I'm at Penn and turn them down because I know that my oldest set of kids were juniors and they wanted to apply to Penn, and me kind of using a legacy and being an alum and being an employee at the university, kind of that access and privilege, you know, I afforded to them by turning the job down was like, well, wait a minute, you know, you're fine when you benefit from it, but when others exercise it in front of you, you get pissed off. And then why is that the case? And so just, you know, all the things and, you know, asking God, why? Lord, why me? Like, I'm your man. I done tried to help so many kids and I'm not perfect, but you know, every blessing that you've bestowed upon me, I've tried to share with others, and really going to him, forgetting that this was a self-created storm, number one. And two, trials and tribulations happen to the just and the unjust. And really three, like going to him with this, with the question of why, not because I was sitting there saying, okay, Lord, what are you really trying to execute? Like, tell me, like, you know, what's going on? I got you. I feel you. All right, I'm willing to go through this. Nah, I wasn't looking for the nutrients. I was complaining. You know what I'm saying? And so, all of these things, I just felt like, you know, throughout the story and how it wrapped around my life, I felt like it was important to completely undress myself and talk about the good guy who's loyal and kind-hearted and loves this community, but who has these bouts of jealousy and envy and the sins of the heart when they get spilled out at the wrong time. You know, you could lose everything. You could lose your witness. You could lose your career. You could lose your family. You could lose, you know, your reputation. You could use, you know, the loss of integrity that comes with it, right? But just saying, you know, I'm a human being that has all these complex issues, right, that unfortunately played out at the wrong time. But you know what? The only way to kind of correct or address these things is to completely be transparent, address myself, talk about them, right, and not feel like I'm on an island all by myself, right? And that is just me, because I don't think, you know, the last thing I say is, I remember Reverend Waller said, is someone waiting for me on the other side of the storm? Well, while I'm going through the storm, I'm not trying to hear it, you know, right. Leave it or nothing. But the reality of it has been so many people have reached out to me who were part of the beta groups that read it to say that my transparency has helped them. And so even if the book only reaches one person, I feel like I was obedient in what I was supposed to deliver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we were kidding before we got on the call. And we said, man, isn't it awful being in this room, being in this hotel room? And you said, hey, it's better than being in a jail cell. And for some, that might just be an off the wall comment, but for you, it's real. I mean, I guess when you count blessings, and I know we've referred to the story specifically for people who aren't familiar with it, just in a nutshell, but you took money, a bribe from a physician who wanted to get his son into Wharton and on the basketball team. And I guess the question, because I clearly I've not known you as long as Ken, but I've covered your career. We had numerous conversations and shared, podiums and that kind of stuff. And you were just this heroic figure. And I guess to an extent you kind of still are. What, and I'm always curious about this, when I speak to athletes who have had a fall, whether it's Marion Jones or whomever, and I said, I wonder, how do you explain this, as you just mentioned, to your children, particularly this generation when all they got to do is Google, like all your grandchildren got to do is now Google, and they'll see the whole story. And what has been your relationship with your son, with your both sons, as your life goes on, their life goes on? How do you explain, like you say, being a human being? And sometimes human beings do things that they never thought they'd ever do. They would be in situations that you never thought they'd be in. Right. What are those kind of conversations like?
So in the book, there's one part I tell a story about having to tell my youngest son, who was nine at the time, that I was on house arrest. He was in Philly when the probation officers came and put the braces on my ankle, and he was coming back to Boston at the end of the summer to start the school year, I was nervous. I had already admitted to the Celtics what I did, admitted to my wife, and obviously the University of Penn knew, and my older kids were aware. But him being nine and going into the fourth grade, we tried to kind of keep him as insulated as we possibly could. But I had to have that conversation with him. And so I was more worried about that than anything, because, I'm his dad. And to my face, he's always like, dad, like, you old, you ugly, you not a better player than I was when I was your age. And you don't know this, you don't know that. But to his friends, I'm his dad. Yeah, my dad, work out with NBA players, and my dad is on the coach. And I know he holds me in such like high esteem. And that was a tough one. But fast forward, the day I got off house arrest, him and my youngest daughter were fighting to see who was going to cut the location monitor off my ankle. They both had a pair of scissors in their hand trying to cut it off. And they almost cut my Achilles. But watching them kind of like fight to kind of release me, for lack of a better way to say. That was probably the day that I let go all the guilt that still remained, because it was almost as if like they were free and they're dead, for lack of a better way of saying it. It almost told me that it's okay, Dad. Like, you know, it's okay. Like, we still love you. And, you know, like, you know, it was hard. You know, my oldest daughter, she, you know, they're a set of twins, a boy and a girl. Right? So, hey, graduation is over. He goes off to South Africa to do a fellowship in Cape Town. And his twin sister, she has a semester left because she transferred from the College of Arts and Sciences at Penn into the School of Nursing. And so that kind of put her a semester behind. And so she has to go back to campus and live on campus, you know, while all my stuff is out, right? And so how does she feel, right, in this space where, you know, people, she always say, people would come up and ask her how I was doing before they would ask how she was doing, right? Mm. And I know that had to be hard. And I know they're like upset and angry and you know, I would be too, and confused. And like I said in the book, my youngest daughter, her comment app essay to 15 schools that she applied to, she wrote an essay. She never really talked about. I asked them all, tell me how y'all feel. Like, be unapologetic, be raw. It's just, you say whatever you want. And she really couldn't express to me how she felt. So she decided to write her comment app essay, you know, about it. And so, you know, through it all, I mean, obviously my wife kind of, like, you know, we talk about me being present in the house, but with no presence, right? And how me hiding behind his mask and all these other settings that I was in, right? Going to work, still doing my scouting reports and video edits and servicing, you know, the guys and being engaging and smiling and laughing and joking, and then getting home and just dumping everything on her, right? And wanting her to be my place of rest, right? Have her rub my head and put her arm around me and say everything will be okay. She didn't have it to give. So instead, me walking around angry because, like, it was draining, and I was sad and scared and nervous and not being able to confess these things to her, right? I just developed this shield and just kind of really did her a disservice in terms of not having the presence that, you know, this woman who has such a nurturing spirit, deserves. And so from my wife to the kids, like, they all kind of processed it a little different. But, you know, but through it all, like, you know, they, you know, I say at the end, like, they stood in the mud with me. And that's kind of what allowed me to still go, like, to work, you know, every day, not knowing if I was going to have a job or not knowing if, you know, what was, if they were going to come and kick the door in and come, you know, come arrest me. But just trying to mask everything and still, you know, see certain things in certain spaces. But, you know, kids are unreal in terms of how they handled it. I'm grateful.
Our conversation with Kenneth Shropshire, Bill Roden, and Jerome Allen continues next week in part two of the Jerome Allen interview and his new book, When the Alphabet Comes. So be sure to subscribe to the Global Sport Matters podcast to make sure that episode gets delivered to your podcast feed. The Global Sport Matters podcast is a production of the Global Sport Institute and Global Sport Matters. This episode was produced by Kendall Jones and by me, Andrew Ramsamy. Our manager for marketing and communications is Crisal Valencia. To stay up to date with the latest stories, events, and podcasts from us, be sure to subscribe to our newsletter on globalsportmatters.com. Until next time, thanks for listening.